Hello, and welcome to another exciting episode of Poetry in the Air, a Right Attitude radio show. This program is brought to you by the Office of Quality Enhancement Plan. The Right Attitude is Savannah State University's campus-wide initiative that enhances student learning by fostering positive attitudes toward writing. I'm your host, Melvina Sykes. Today on our show, Poetry is in the Air, we'll be hearing from Frank X. Walker. He's the recipient of numerous literary awards and the author of 8 books of poetry. And he is an associate professor of English at the University of Kentucky and that state's poet laureate. Mr. Walker came to Savannah State University campus in October 2016 to talk about his career in writing, discuss his activism, explain his vision of the artist's role in society, and to share his poetry. Doctors Camila Martin and Chad Ferries from Savannah State's Department of English, Languages, and Cultures bring us this interview.
I'm Dr. Camila Martin, Associate Professor of English here at Savannah State University. We have Dr. Ferries, also Associate Professor of Creative Writing here at Savannah State University, and our distinguished guest, poet Frank X. Walker. So we'll jump right into it. I'm going to let you go ahead and finish the story about challenging one of the former poets that visited Savannah State here to do some better work. So tell us about that.
Well, Maria Dessa and I and about 40 other people were at a winter retreat for young writers, young as in not age, but as in closer to novice, with a nice mixture of experienced writers, you know, just trying to share the wealth and mm-hmm. trying to help everybody get to a stronger place and closer to publishing and to share secrets to surviving in the industry and recommending MFA programs if that's what they needed, or publishing houses or conferences to go to. So it was a really good time. And it closed with a reading, a public reading. And she read one or two, maybe two of her letters. And I was just blown away. I'd heard about them, but never had heard them. And to hear it live and have her energy behind it, I mean, it just moved me to insist that be somewhere on the way to being a book, like immediately. And I just refused to accept that she was thinking about it or she wasn't as close as I thought she should have been. So I put a little pressure on her. And then made an arrangement to acquire numerous copies as soon as they were available in advance, so they were able to actually pay to finish the book. But I think everybody responded that way. You know, my good friend and colleague, Dr. Curlew, actually was one of the editors of the book and spent, you know, real time on the ground, you know, going through every single line. And I think I still have several hundred copies in my car that when I travel around, I give them away to young writers, you know. A lot of young people who are interested in activism ask me questions that the best answer is just to give them that book. And I think there's nothing more powerful than to have a tool that not only, you know, gives you instructions on how to do what you only dream about, but show you in the ways it's been done before. And then gives you even more stuff on top of that. I think that's what you get with her book.
I think that, so since we're talking about this, to contextualize this conversation,
right,
Camila, maybe you could read one
from
our literary journal.
Oh, absolutely.
So this is our literary journal, Estuary, and we framed this particular one with one of these letters that we're talking about from Mariah Dessa Kiritali. And maybe this one here, letter 14, Dear Continuum.
Sounds good to me.
And it's kind of a neat way to start our conversation, I think.
Letter 14. Dear Continuum, do I think suffering is a prerequisite for great artistry? No, I don't. What I think is that most people suffer at some point. The artist just dares to admit it. I think awareness, empathy, strong observation skills, and the ability to listen deeply are necessary tools for any artist. Wisdom, coupled with the ability to admit that you really don't know much of anything, are also instruments that will help you shape your art. Do you ever listen to the blues? If not, I recommend you dip your toes in the sounds of Big Mama Thornton, Bessie Smith, Ida Cox, Howlin' Wolf, Leadbelly, and Son House. In Uses of the Blues, James Baldwin writes that, quote, blues contain the toughness that manages to make our experiences articulate, end quote. The blues is a testimony to our survival, strength, beauty, ugly, and humor. It's a map, and the mere singing of it is the key. To navigate this sometimes rocky terrain of life, we have to tell our stories. In that same essay, Baldwin writes, quote, you don't know what the river is like or what the ocean is like by standing on the shore. You can't know anything about life and suppose you can get through it clean, end quote. Let me know what you think this means. Continuum. When life is everything that the movies told you it would be, right. When life threatens to shatter you and rip your illusions to shreds, right. When you are distracted by romance, right. When you are consumed by heartache, right. When you are rejoicing, grieving, questioning, certain, right. Life itself will give you a chance to feel everything. I've never set a fire to feel flames singe me. I already know flames will come. So will water. One, Mariah Dessa.
Nice.
That was beautiful. That was beautiful.
They are.
A good quota to a literary magazine full of student art.
Yeah. Looks quite substantial. Is this from one whole year?
It's substantial because it ended up being 2 years.
Yeah. Well, that explains it. Okay. That's,
so the next one's going to be half as big.
Right, yeah.
War and peace over here.
Yeah.
All right. Wonderful.
Well, great. Well, yeah, go ahead.
To back up a little bit, we know that you are the founder of one of the founders of the Afro-Latian Poets, and so I wanted you to talk a little bit about that term. Can you define it and tell us what Afro-Latian is all about?
What I appreciate Afro-Latian, you have to start with Appalachia and understand that most people respond to Appalachia by the stereotype that is advanced by mass media, mm-hmm. which is a region of the country that is the poorest in the nation, that is culturally backwards, that is unlettered, almost illiterate, and homogeneously white. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That there are no people of color in that space. That's the definition that mass media sells. And they're not even stereotypes. They're actually caricatures by now because mm-hmm. most of those are not true for, you know, all 13 states. You can find pockets of that truth, but it doesn't represent the whole. The truth is that same space is also the same home of Nina Simone, of Carter G. Woodson, the father of African-American history, mm-hmm. you know, of Bill Withers, of the Carolina Chocolate Drops, of Roberta Flack, Jesse Owens, you know, August Wilson. Mm-hmm. I mean, so much African-American culture that if you put that on top of all those stereotypes, you know, Little Abner starts to disappear. So when we use the word Afro-Latia, it's to insist that you look at the same region and acknowledge that people of color live there. And are from there, and not just now, but historically, were there mining coal, were there with Native Americans. Native Americans represent some of that forced Afro-Latian definition, too. I started a group called the Afro-Latian Poets, and that's a group of multicultural writers, multi-ethnic, you know, Puerto Rican, Chinese American, you know, there we had two honorary white members in the very first year we formed. Mm-hmm. There was a young woman who was Lebanese-American who was a member of the group. But the word does one thing, the writing group does the other. And the writing group existed, kind of forced the literary community in the region to make room for us. When I first tried to be part of that literary scene, it was very established and very clear that it was a whites-only enterprise. And so our organization pushed back against that. You know, when we would go to events and we would say, why aren't there any black writers represented? They would always say, we don't know any, or there aren't any. Yeah. And we would look around at each other, all writers of color, saying, are we invisible? You know, do we not exist? So our history, our formation comes out of that space of trying to make our own selves visible, and force them to acknowledge that we exist. And now it's, you know, we're happy to know that that word is in the Oxford American Dictionary, that there probably isn't an Appalachian Studies program anywhere in the country that when they study diversity, that they don't have to say Afrolatia, that one of our many books aren't used as a supplemental textbook. That, you know, we tour extensively, and one of the places we go every year is Appalachian State University in Boone, North Carolina. In fact, I'll be there Thursday night with four other members of the group. And there are over 30 of us by now, you know, since the 25 years ago we were formed. I mean, we've had one of the oldest active writing groups of color in the country. And most of the founding members are now university professors or part of other writing programs at University of South Carolina, Nikki Finney, Kelly Norman Ellis at Chicago State University, you know, Paul Taylor at Penn State University, Mitch Douglas is at IUPUI in Indianapolis, I'm at the University of Kentucky, Ricardo Nazario Colon is at Western Carolina University. So we're all over the region, and some outside the traditional definition of what the Appalachia is, but we recognize out migrants, you know, places like Cincinnati and Detroit, Philadelphia, Pittsburgh is still in Appalachia. But those other cities, because of the industry and jobs available there, have large, traditionally Appalachian, Afro-Latian communities because people move there to get jobs, but they still stay connected to home.
Right.
They might even work there and then die and want to be buried back home. And most of them still own at least a piece of the original family's property, if they own land at all. You know, so it's something we're very proud of, and you know, to have been around and alive for 25 years, actively writing and publishing and teaching, and you know, forcing people to see us has been part of our movement in the world. I think that's fair to say.
Wonderful. Well, you anticipated my next question about the 25th anniversary of the group. So I'll switch gears a little bit. Speaking of people, forcing people to see the group, word on the street is that that the group was awarded the 2016 Governor's Award in the Arts, to which the group responded by outright rejecting that award. Could you tell us a little bit about that controversy?
Well, I mean, to us, it was an easy response, automatic response. You know, in Kentucky just elected a Republican governor whose policies have been anti everything that the Appalachian Poet stands for politically. You know, we consider ourselves not just poets, but many of us are very comfortable claiming to be artist activists. And you know, we're champions of the marginalized, the disadvantaged, of the poor, whatever color they are. His policies, you know, try to decriminalize ex-felons, try to keep them out of the voting process. You know, his policies try to penalize poor people and remove a brand new privilege they had, which was healthcare. You know, he wanted to take it away because it wasn't his. It wasn't his, you know, his political party's gift to, you know, he wanted to put his own spin on it and take it away. So between, you know, his criminal justice stance, his politics around healthcare, you know, his position on the minimum wage and not wanting to raise it. Mm-hmm. It was easy to find his five major initiatives to be anti the people we valued and loved and wrote about. So it took us 5 minutes to figure out that we couldn't take his award. We wouldn't want anything with his name on it, because it might look like we were, you know, we sanctioned or we agree with anything he did. Mm-hmm. You know, so we met on the phone and online, and we crafted a press release and released it 2 days after the announcement on Facebook, and it almost went viral in like 12 hours. Mm-hmm. But what amazed us is that there were so many people who agreed with us, mm-hmm. that were almost waiting for somebody to say, you know, you can say no, you can say that I think that's wrong. And that kind of energy, you know, was probably right on time. So there's a kind of activism growing in Kentucky. You know, Kentucky is a traditional red state, which has a very strong chance of voting blue this presidential election. And part of it, you know, we take credit for is this new activism among the artist class in Kentucky, which is a very large, mm-hmm. vocal, active voting public. You know, partly due to the fact that Kentucky has one of the largest governor's schools for the arts and governor's scholars program in the country, mm-hmm. even more than North Carolina, and they have their own campus, and more than New York City, and they have all those arts in New York City, but Kentucky, for whatever reasons, has always invested a lot in the arts. And, you know, those 35 years of young artists now working and living in the state are voting, and they've galvanized around this idea that artists have a voice, and they're speaking up. So we're looking for some exciting change come November 8th.
All right. So are we.
Right.
So, to piggyback on that, as a fellow poet, so you're choosing poetry to communicate these feelings and these political things and so on. Why poetry? Why not essays or visual arts, or are other people in the Afro-Latchian movement doing that?
We have artists of every genre.
Okay,
and I'm actually a multidisciplinary artist. I'm best known as a poet, but I'm trained as a fiction writer. You know, I finished my first novel, and it's been edited right now. My first publishing success was in short fiction. My first book, Afro-Latchian, was supposed to be a combination of short stories and poetry. And then when the editors got all the poems, they wanted to see more poems. They liked the poems so much, they decided to delay the short stories and just publish the poems. And then 16,000 copies later, they're still about to put out the 10th edition of that book. And still are sitting on the short stories, which I've even forgotten by now. I don't even, I can barely remember what they were about. I write plays. I had my most recent play was staged again 2 months ago in my hometown of Danville at the Frank X. Walker Literary Festival. It's a play about Isaac Murphy, the African-American Jackie. But I've written a dozen plays. My first real job in the world was as a journalist in Tennessee. I don't think of myself as a poet, but as a writer. And before even a writer, as an artist activist, because I also make visual art. Mostly photography now, but there was a time when I paid the rent and paid for my daughter's food with the art I made with my hands. And I just don't have time to do that anymore, because I was trying to be an administrator, an artist, and a writer, and be alive at the same time. Mm-hmm. And so something I always suffered because I was trying. I was spread myself too thin, and I consciously made a decision to stop making visual art and focus on writing. So I could produce something, because I was always not finishing stuff. And I was laughing because, you know, I was like, we got to make sure we found all the places where the old bio is so old, and undated, because we went 2 years without updating the website. And a lot of people have the information, but it's now 8 books and over 400, places presenting that. But I always laugh when I hear that, because I think, wow, I went 2 years without updating that website. That's my fault. But that's evidence of being overcommitted and trying to take on too much and really trying to get to it eventually. It was my excuse. I was always trying to put out fires. I felt like a website, it was never on fire until you go somewhere and they introduce you, and it's 2 years out of, out of date, and it's your fault. Mm-hmm. It's like, ouch. But thanks to good people in my life, they're trying to fix those things, and I have a brand new website that's been updated, and I think it needs updating on a regular basis, it seems, But I think that, I think people are always surprised that I don't use an agent or I don't have handlers. I just give out my email address, a phone number, and try to keep up with it all. But
so can I do a follow-on?
Sure.
So that's great. You work in multiple genres. And because of that, do you feel then that poetry, getting back to the idea of poetry, is there anything in poetry that has maybe that there's something there that you can communicate through poetry that maybe you can't communicate through a short story, through your visual arts, through something like that? Is there something that makes poetry unique in its capacity to communicate some of these issues of social justice and so on that you address?
I don't know that poetry is privileged over other art forms. I think it may be the most accessible. It might be the most broadly used language that people speak. And I think of poetry as a language. What I like about poetry is the economy, is that, you have the privilege and challenge to capture everything you get in a 2.5 hour long movie, but you only have 14 lines or 17 syllables. Mm-hmm. But you still have to give people that, opening and closing, that building, to something, and then, that solution at the end. You can't cheat people just because it's short.
Right.
But I think it makes it harder to do. It's harder to produce. But it's more satisfying when you've done it. I think I turn to poetry because I could get results easier. If I just said I'm a fiction writer, then I'd be introduced always as a failed fiction writer and not a poet at all, because that novel has not come out yet. Nobody's seen it but my editors. But because you can write a poem in a day or an hour, depending on the length of it, and there's so many places to publish these days, so many things online. Now that online forums are respected. I first came into teaching in the academy, you couldn't mention that you had a poem published online. People would laugh at you. You couldn't count that towards tenure. But now there are very well-respected journals online, and they do count. And between that and Kinko's, anybody can call themselves a poet and then prove that they're being published in the same breath. But I think, which makes it harder, puts more pressure on other writers to distinguish themselves from people who went to a poetry reading and said, I could do that, and the next day they introduced themselves as a poet without any training or having not read any other poets, or may have only written 3 poems in their entire life, but now they're a poet. How do you separate those, from the Chads in the world? I think that's...
How do you do that?
Well,
it's tough. I think about that too. And it happens with poetry so much. Mm-hmm. Like, nobody paints a picture and then the next day says,
I'm a painter,
yeah. I'm a visual artist. But they'll write a poem and the next day. And I don't want to discourage those people. I want them to feel strong and be excited about poetry and keep moving forward. But yeah, somebody who's practiced for, 30 years, mm-hmm. I surely feel like I feel like there's something that I need to earn. I need to, poetry is practice, mm-hmm. a lot of practice. you don't strum a chord on a guitar and the next day you're in a rock and roll band, you know? So how do you feel about that?
Well, you know, I think there's room for, you know, I think my thing is, you know, how can we, if we can stoke the enthusiasm for people, the world needs poets and needs poetry. I mean, there's a lot of ugly in the world that needs healing, that needs, you know, rubbing out. You know, if we could fix it with poems, then let's fix it. And I think that for me, my students probably motivate me the most as far as wanting to write, you know. And I get an amazing student who's writing circles around the person I was at the same age. You know, I'm thinking, I got to work harder, you know. So it's put pressure on me to really push myself and my work, and probably made me more prolific. I mean, I don't know a lot of poets who write as much as I do. You know, I just had a book come out last month. I have another book that's finished. I just haven't found the time to put it together and to turn it in. And by the time I do that, there'll be another book. But it's because I'm writing all the time, and I'm writing all the time because I'm in this creative space that's fueled by students, you know, reading their work. You know, once a month I'll read something and say, I wish I had written that, you know. And I don't want them to catch me, you know. I've got to stay ahead. But you know, I think it's. I don't really worry about that. I worry if students are not reading. You know, if young people call themselves poets, and I say, well, what have you read? What are you reading? Mm-hmm. And they can't answer that. You know, I'm really trying to find a nice way of saying, stop calling yourself a poet. Mm-hmm. If you don't read poetry, don't call you. You know, at least say you're reading your own work. You know, be that arrogant. Yeah. That mm-hmm. I had a friend who was a comedian, and I said, well, you know, what other comedians do you like? He said, I don't watch other comedians. I don't want to be influenced. You know, I just want to be myself. I was thinking, well, you would never get better unless you know what else is being produced. And right, he just refused to sit that way. It's like, no, it'll taint me somehow. Mm-hmm. So I think that's you can't do that in poetry. You need to know what's out there. You need to be reading. And there's so many exciting things happening in poetry right now. I'm in love with all these new forms. The contrapuntal, for instance. And if you look at the work of Tembi Jess, you know, he was just at UK, and you know, he did a slide presentation to show what his new work looked like on the page. He put it on the big screen, and to see a crown of sonnets all connected, and to see him connect these sonnets that can be read, you know, up and down and diagonal across the page and still make sense. Just, I mean, it's like, it was a calculus. Mm-hmm. We should have been at a math conference. I'm like, this is a long way from, you know, the haikus I learned when I was in the 10th grade. This is rocket science now, and it's still poetry. You know, so, you know, seeing where poetry is and heading, and being part of what I think is, you know, will be a respected new genre as soon as libraries and publishers decide that, you know, there's enough historical poetry to name it that category. Mm-hmm. And give it its own shelf in the bookstore, you know. We've made some progress, but, you know, I feel good knowing that I'm the only person who has 4 historical books of poetry.
Right.
Or even 3, maybe even 2, you know. I think Marilyn Nelson is in 2nd right now. We've been keeping pace. and when the New York book comes out, you know, I'll get a bigger lead on Marilyn because I have 5. But it's not a contest. You know, the contest is our collective effort to make the parties that be who make that call say, yes, historical poetry is a legitimate genre of poetry and deserves its own space and shelf. And here are all the ones that qualify. I mean, it doesn't hurt that, you know, they make the final list for National Book Awards. You know, Adrian Matejic's book about Jack Johnson from last year, you know, almost won the mm-hmm. National Book Award and was nominated for the Pulitzer also, you know, so that really helped our cause. So it's getting a lot more respect. They're being used a lot in, not just in English classes, but, you know, my books are used as supplemental history texts.
I want to go back to something that you said about poetry as a healing balm. Particularly as we're thinking about this historical poetry and and what it can do in a classroom. And I taught Turn Me Loose last spring, and something really interesting happened by being able to walk these students who were, for the most part, unfamiliar with Medgar Evers, mm-hmm. unfortunately. They were able to walk through this collection to get this story and feel very deeply about not just Evers and his sacrifice, but that collective community, a community that they now feel a part of, in terms of looking at this text as a type of healing. So I'm curious about your, other than wanting to tell a story, tell the story that people don't hear, tell it from a different perspective, what's also, what else is the purpose behind, you know, a whole collection around a single person or a single incident? Is the intent to heal? Is the intent to simply just open up new ways of seeing the story? I'm curious, how do you think of your poetry as a healing balm, a possibility for healing?
Well, you know, I think that it is very intentional. And I think that it's not often I get to talk about even the details of Turn Me Loose, because mm-hmm. Some people only look at it in a very one-dimensional way. Mm-hmm. But for me, the most important thing about Turn Me Loose is the architecture of the book. The book itself is actually built on two songs. Mm-hmm. It built on mm-hmm. Dixie mm-hmm. and Strange Fruit. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the lyrics from those two songs are pulled out in our, you know, section heads all the mm-hmm. way through the book. And then it sets up this conversation between this dark thing and this, you know, lighter force all the way through the book, so that you get, you know, the voice of the assassin followed by the voice of the, you know, of the widow mm-hmm. in the same space. And it allows you to be in this conversation about race when it connects with violence, mm-hmm. you know, as a consequence of hatred, mm-hmm. all the way through this book, and really interrogate it in such a way that by the end of it, you know, not only are you emotionally exhausted, mm-hmm. but hopefully you've experienced something emotional that, whether you know it or not, is a kind of healing mm-hmm. because of the book is intentionally structured to kind of mimic, if you think about what happened in South Africa, you know, with, you know, bringing both sides of this, you know, old conflict to the same space to admit these, you know, these crimes to the victims, you know, mm-hmm. And then to, you know, get one side to forgive the other and move them closer. And so that both of their lives are less weighted because now they don't have the guilt of committing the crimes totally, and the other is not the pain of never had a chance to face your, you know, the person who victimized you. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That reconciliation, I believe, is modeled in the book on purpose, and it's also why the book ends with a timeline that talks about, you know, major clashes around race in America that. And that by now is dated because it starts with Trayvon Martin, mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. That page would have been reprinted every 2 months in America since then, mm-hmm. Since 2013, because it seems like every 2 months since then there's been a new Trayvon Martin in America that becomes the new rallying cry. But you can see how it's connected, so you can go backwards also, because there are young people who had never connected Trayvon Martin mm-hmm. to Emmett Till. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So they can see that line, and now Emmett Till is not just a line in a rap song. You know, it's not just something they heard from an era that they don't even acknowledge mm-hmm. and have no emotional connection to. He's connected to Trayvon, which they feel deeply about.
Right.
So now they can feel, you know, Emmett Till, and now that whole era is relevant.
Right.
And so what I love about historical poetry, you know, the way it's being written today is that it allows the reader to, you know, this kind of proximity to the emotional temperature of the event that makes it more real to them, mm-hmm. you know. In a way that you read history and it's kind of dry and you have the facts and you walk away, you read an editorial and this person is very passionate about what happened and maybe he's even convincing you how to believe, but historical poetry puts both those things in the same space. So experiencing history in a way that reminds you that this is significant and important to you, then you come away thinking, wow, you know, that's... So they don't just learn about Medgar Evers the way you taught in your classroom. You know, they learn how important he was to the people in his generation. And then they know how important, who that person is in their own generation. And they make the connection. So I love it when kids can see those bridges. If a book of poetry can do that, can build bridges emotionally and historically, it's doing more than poetry was ever supposed to do, according to the definition. But I think that's the value, that's the richness that's waiting for that official genre acknowledgement that's coming at some point. But because I think, you know, these books keep coming, you know. I'm not the only one writing them, and between Marilyn Nelson and I, you know, we've got half a shelf covered. But we both know and are working with, you know, a bunch of other writers. I have a student in my class now whose first book will be a collection of personal poems about the Negro Baseball League, you know, about one player in particular, Josh Gibson, who he's been writing and working on these poems for 4 years now. Wow. I mean, they are amazing. And he studied with, you know, Jess and Matijic and Red Miller Nelson is in my classrooms, and you know, so he's learning how to do that and growing as a poet and as a person at the same time. So
I'm Dr. Lisa Yaunt, the director of the Write Attitude program at Savannah State University. Here's the writing tip of the day.
I am Sarah Dillard, a sophomore majoring in civil engineering and technology at Savannah State University. As a peer tutor at the SSU Writing Center, I bring you the Write Attitude writing tip of the day. There is more to research than Wikipedia. Savannah State offers many resources for student writers. Use the online databases, go to the library to visit the reference librarians, or set an appointment with the Writing Center to get help finding accurate and reliable resources.
The Write Attitude Writing Tip of the Day is brought to you by the SSU Writing Center and the Office of the Quality Enhancement Plan. The Write Attitude is Savannah State University's campus-wide initiative to enhance student learning by improving attitudes about writing. Visit the SSU Writing Center in Payne Hall to get assistance with your writing projects, and to learn more about how you can improve your writing attitudes and skills, visit qep.savannahstate.edu.
Welcome back to Poetry in the Air, a Write Attitude radio show. I'm your host, Melvina Sykes. We've been listening to a conversation with writer, professor, and poet laureate Frank X. Walker. Now let's return to Mr. Walker's visit and listen in as he shares his work and wisdom with the students and faculty on the Savannah State University campus.
Recipe for seafood. Ingredients: millions of stolen Africans, partially clothed in chain, tight packed, wombs full of eggs, uninvited man seed soaked in rum, vats of cold porridge, no saltpeter, decorum, or respect, 1/4 ocean of African sea salt, 1 whole ocean, a cross. Directions: preheat hull to 300 degrees Fahrenheit, lightly grease a 2x5 foot wooden banking plank with excrement. Gather captives in small groups, make them dance on a rocking deck, beat. Drench with cold water, stare, lust, rape, salt, repeat. Teach them to jump rope with a cat o' nine tails, rape, starve. Stuff with cold porridge, stomp out resistance, one head at a time. Brand, drink, laugh, break, brag, toss what remains into the sea. Slow bake in an oven for 2.5 months, or until a toothpick inserted into the center of her bread comes out clean. What I want to remember. What I want to remember is not the sea salt from the cold, cold baths that turned our bruises into screams,
But the salt in the ocean, falling down your cheeks, sorrow tributaries to the river between twin breasts, filling the drinking gourd around your navel and the wading pool in the small of your back. What I want to remember is not how they broke us one at a time, but what resistance sounds like when air is sucked through teeth, how it looks in the right eyes. What I want to remember is not how long I couldn't touch you, but how I long to and how I long to now. It's called Sacred Dance. Somewhere between the corny boogie walks and the promenade kick into an underarm turn, my mind drifts again. Instead of focusing on the transitions, eight counts, and shining for an imaginary audience in a ballroom, I am seaside. I am chained to all my people, and we are learning a new step. I miss my turn. The music stops, and we start all over again, again. My feet are performing a mutiny because I am two-fifths maroon and old-school hoofer all the way down to my big toes. The Denmark Vesey in my bloodline turns a square dance into a Lindy Hop, a Viennese waltz into a slow dance, drag, dance hall mix. I cannot focus here because what I need to get back to whole is to be entangled with you, not to watch dull Jane and Dick teach the tango, and not here, not with them for whom dancing is choreographed marching and counting and patriarchal rules about who leads and who follows. I miss my turn. The music stops and we start all over again, again. I need to move together to the music of my true love's hips, not to mimic exercise on a ship. I need our bodies to organize, not colonize, to Amistad, not obey the whip, to resist, to engage each other in call and response. On the dance floor, the way sand on the beach and seafoam flirt, the way we move to each other's heartbeats, governed by our breaths and nature's universal rhythms, not numbers. I don't want to just follow the music. I want to make love to my woman on the dance floor. I want to start an uprising with my clothes on, and I don't want to feel the beat. For Riesling. Thomas Jefferson speaking. I've always favored a full-bodied Merlot, but I digress. I volunteer that I was simply following a silk-throated dove song rising from my room of books when I first encountered a head of flowing locks buried in my bilingual translation of Julius Caesar. I stood back a pace in some confusion, knowing that women in general prefer being read to over actual reading. I played the voyeur as this one drew down, swooned, and gasped when her fingers teased open the firm leather covers and caressed the parchment and linen sheets each held, as if she were tracing her own delicate brow in a mirror. I lingered on the edge of her circle of light, cast by the kerosene globe, hiding just inside the hips of her own shadow, as she meticulously fingered the spines of memory, reason, and imagination. When she discovered me over her shoulder, such was the color that rushed to her cheeks, I took her for a moment for a white woman. Here's a short poem that lists some of these recollections, called Recollections. Number 611, that first winter when you stood behind the door wrapped in virgin wool from stocking to shawl, sipping on a mug of hot cider, ignoring our frostbitten feet and the cracked and bloody hands that chopped and carried in more cherry and oak for your already roaring fire, before sending us back to bitter cabins where we were each other's only kindling and flame. Number 729, each time you added up your taxable property and recognized that next to the land itself, me and mine were the most valuable things you own, but still treated us like nothing. Number two, your eyes, when witnessing your purse, approach the heaviness of our tears each day at the auction block. After so much quiet, my ears begin to catch every little sound, a scared deer's heart drum, oak trees yawning, a snake shedding his skin, the morning shaking off its dew. When I listen close, I don't just hear but can feel a low-flying hawk screech, shoot straight through me and leave me trembling all on the inside like the thickest of metal dew when kissed by a blacksmith's hammer. Ain't truly known such sound since the burial out back of the quarter, when a woman's long, wide scream sliced up the air and everybody in it. Her wailing, two parts field holler, one part falling off a mountain, wrapped in a blanket of pain. I knowed even non-believers heard it deep in their bones when white folks tipped off, heads down, stinking with guilt. While us so-called men measuring ourselves against our anger, against our choices, pretended to hear nothing at all. One of the things about that period of enslavement, New Orleans was supposedly kind of the seat of the most heinous slavery in the United States, where it was understood that slaves were worked to death. That's when you died and how you died in most cases. And there's also a reference to how women died in this poem, so listen closely. It's also famous for Congo Square, where they actually gathered together and played African drums, which was unusual because nowhere else in the United States were slaves allowed to still communicate or play and touch a drum because they were afraid they were communicating with each other. So this is called At Least Them Have the Drum. Back in Kentucky, they'll make us dig a hole as far away from where they bury their own kin as possible. Might let us wrap bodies in muslin, but never waste a box or send along something they might need. Never let us mark the grave with more than a stone or sing over it. They might throw some dirt and sprinkle a few white words about a white heaven, but never let our living just sit with our dead, as if we don't get torn up on the inside, as if they way is the only way to let go, the only way to raise up the fallen. In New Orleans, the worst place to be property, them believe they good masters because they don't feed the bodies to the pigs. Then swear they soft-hearted because they enjoy how our people celebrate another great escape. Every time them work a man or rut a woman to death. But this is called Music as Medicine. This is York speaking. Listening to crickets and other crawling things find their part in the night's song. Put me in mind of Sundays in the quarter and how my people sitting round and feeling empty might slowly gather together in the space of each other's breath to sing. How they always build a song that might start with a steady hand on a thigh, a heavy foot or solid stick setting down a heartbeat that everybody can lean into with their eyes closed before stacking other sounds right on top of it. Might be a well-timed hand clap or moan. Might be the rattling sound of a mess of dry beans or corn in a wooden bowl. Any kind or size wood on wood can speak truth, can scratch, click, or clack. Anything under the right hand can say doon doon, can say out loud how you really feel. And when that song starts rising, everybody of every age can't help but join in. Mothers rocking babies and humming, old folks nodding heads, young feet kicking up their heels and toes in the dirt, or just dragging them to the music our living together make, as it rises and rises until everybody who felt empty now feel full. In the voice of Byron De La Beckwith, like them, a man can conceive an idea, an event, a moment so clearly he can name it even before it breathes. We both can carry a thing around inside for only so long, and no matter how small it starts out, it can swell and get so heavy our backs hurt, and we can't find comfort enough to sleep at night. All we can think about is the relief that waits at the end. When it was finally time, it was painless. It was the most natural thing I'd ever done. I just closed my eyes and squeezed, then opened them, and there he was, just laying there, still covered with blood, but already trying to crawl. I must admit, Like any proud parent, I was afraid at first, afraid he'd live, afraid he'd die too soon. Funny how life and death is a whole lot of pushing and pulling, holding and seeking breath, a whole world turned upside down until somebody screams. Hopefully you can feel a dark tone in that poem.
You're listening to Poetry in the Air, a Right Attitude radio show. After our 1 minute break, we'll come back with more from Frank X. Walker.
I'm Dr. Lisa Yont, the director of the Right Attitude program at Savannah State University. Here's the writing tip of the day.
Hello, my name is LaShante Grant. I'm a student writing fellow tutor at the Writing Center. I'm here to give you some tips on writing. When you are writing for any class, all outside material must be cited, even if your professor has not explicitly stated this. Many instructors expect you to already know that you need to cite. If you are unsure how to cite correctly, it is important to ask your professor so that you are not accused of plagiarism.
The Right Attitude Writing Tip of the Day is brought to you by the SSU Writing Center and the Office of the Quality Enhancement Plan. The Right Attitude is Savannah State University's campus-wide initiative to enhance student learning by improving attitudes about writing. Visit the SSU Writing Center in Payne Hall to get assistance with your writing projects, and to learn more about how you can improve your writing attitudes and skills, visit qep.savannahstate.edu.
We're not done yet. Here's some of poetry from Frank X. Walker.
This is called Sorority Meeting. Merle Evers speaks to Willie and Thelma De La Beckwith. My faith urges me to love you. My stomach begs me to not. All I know is that day made us sisters somehow. After long, nervous nights and trials on end, we are bound together in this unholy sorority of misery. I think about you every time I run my hands across the echoes in the hollows of my sheets. They seem loudest just before I wake. I open my eyes every morning, half expecting Megger to be there. Then I think about you, and your eyes always snatch me back. Your eyes won't let me forget. We are sorority sisters now, with a gut-wrenching country ballad for a sweetheart song, tired funeral and courtroom clothes for colors, and secrets we would take to our grave. I was forced to sleep night after night after night with a ghost. You chose to sleep with a killer. We all pledged our love, crossed our hearts, and swallowed oaths before being initiated with a bullet. And the last one from this series I read is actually in the voice of the bullet. And the details are taken straight from the court transcripts that provided a diagram of the path of the bullet and described what was left. You know, there was a bullet fragment that passed through his body into the house and was found in the kitchen on the counter next to a watermelon. 1/3 of 180 grams of lead, the bullet is speaking. Both of them were history, even before one pulled the trigger, before I rocketed through the smoking barrel hidden in the honeysuckle, before I tore through a man's back, shattered his family, a window, and tore through an inner wall, before I bounced off a refrigerator and a coffee pot, before I landed at my destined point in history, next to a watermelon. What was cruel was the irony, not the melon, not the man falling in slow motion, but the man squinting through the crosshairs, reducing the justice system to a small circle, praying that he not miss, then sending me to deliver a message, as if the woman screaming in the dark or the children crying at her feet could ever believe a bullet was small enough to hate. A non-metal box is being cranked as a familiar song fills the air. Round and round the mulberry bush, the monkey chased the weasel. You follow me to a parking lot, barefooted, humming the tune beneath mock begging. Your puppy dog eyes pretend pouting, and the lie that always starts with, "I promise, I'll pay you back this time," aren't working. So you sing louder. Round and round the mulberry bush, the monkey chased the weasel. I've drawn the line at gifts for your children, food, rent, cleaning supplies, and medical emergencies. No liquor or drugs or cash that could become such. You crank up the box again and use an empty parking lot as your stage after you eyeball the cigarette money lounging in the armrest of my chair. Round and round the mulberry bush, the monkey chased the weasel. I remind myself that you've pissed away every nickel you had and that I worked so hard for mine. But somehow all our wallets and hearts have secret chambers that pop open when you perform your song and dance. A penny for a spool of thread, a penny for a needle. It used to be an innocent children's song, locked in a metal box, but you crank it and us every time we come close enough to hear you sing. That's the way the money goes. Pop goes the weasel in such a dark space. It's called "He Was a Bad Mother, Hush Your Mouth." Brother wanted to be like his daddy. Wanted to sing solos on Sundays, wanted to scream into the microphone, wanted to make the congregation moan. Urged on by a diamond-studded bishop who rode around town in a white Cadillac with hair prettier than James Brown's, he learned to rooster strut and entertain down in front of the pulpit, nicknamed himself Pretty and believed it, had a ring for every finger and a closet full of neon suits, matching shoes and belts. In his yearbook photo, he wore Reynolds wrap around his front teeth, a tribute to his daddy's gold grin. He floated into church, draped in costume jewelry, hairstyled in helicopter blades, hovering so far off the ground, he forgot it was our mother's funeral.
That concludes another episode of Poetry in the Air. Thank you for tuning in. Thanks to those who helped make this show about poetry possible. Special thanks to Mr. Frank X. Walker, as well as Drs. Camila Martin and Chad Ferries. Thanks to the QEP's very own Adriana de Oliveira and Dr. Lisa Yant. Thanks to Dr. Dustin Michael for his help in production and Grace Curry at WHCJ for their support. Have a pleasant day and tune in next time for more episodes of Poetry in the Air. I'm Elvina Sykes, your host and editor of the show. Thanks for listening and keep writing. Don't forget that you can listen to all of the Right Attitude radio shows by visiting the Quality Enhancement Plan website, qep.savannahstate.edu. Also, please follow us on Facebook at Right SSU, Twitter at Right SSU, and Instagram at Right_SSU.